take a couple of questions from the group.
I just wanted to ask, given the sort of rising number of natural disasters, and we had obviously the big tsunami in 2004,
yeah.
and a lot of lessons learnt out of that, and then places like the Philippines, which are constantly having disasters, why haven't these lessons kind of been learnt, or why aren't we doing better around tenure security? Why are we still in the situation in Hainan now where they're doing this
yeah.
stuff with that Victoria was talking about, and then coming sort of back to the same conclusion 6 months later or
yeah.
a year later?
I think we're talking a very fragmented organisational environment, so information flows poorly across international agencies, national agencies, local governments. That's one problem. Two, as I said, land is always political, so you're always sort of getting tangled up in the local politics of land. There's often a reason why there's large proportions of renters and informal settlers. And anything that tends to change that can affect power structures. But three, I just want to highlight the structural point. I just think the cluster system is not handling these cross-cutting issues very well. And they talked the talk. They said they would do it. I don't think it's. And you certainly see that in the flash appeal process and the funding, the initial emergency funding, you never, very rarely see a land specialist going very early, which is what we recommend, but it doesn't happen.
Would you agree though that when UN Habitat has the responsibility in the protection cluster for housing, land, and property,
right.
and Habitat deliberately went after that to get into the humanitarian phase, because it's
yeah.
essentially a development organisation.
Right.
And that's the tension, is that you've got problems that have long-term impacts around land and property,
yeah.
which are usually dealt with fully in property in the sort of reconstruction and the development phase.
Yeah.
But the interventions that set the tone or set the constraints or enable actually happen in that humanitarian crisis phase. And you've mentioned a few times the humanitarian response. And my personal thing is there's quite a tension between the humanitarians
yeah.
and the development reconstruction orientated. Do you care to comment?
Yes, I agree. The humanitarians have not bought into this line of argument. But they've got a point. I mean, they're saving lives. They don't want to give them. But personally, I think the experience has been that it's a mistake not to address. The other problem is that Habitat... it's always looking for money to fund these positions. So they'll get a request, but they need the money to do it. It's not like they've got a standing body of experienced practitioners who can fly out at a minute's notice. They don't. They get the request. They then start emailing people who've consulted for them and then look for money to do it. So they've got a capacity problem.
I guess just following up from that, I mean, that's, I guess, the part of the problems you pointed out in the cluster system, that was the reason they set out the Notable Recovery Cluster.
Yes.
That's how we were supposed to work.
Right.
On the transition from humanitarian emergency to longer term
yeah.
development, you know, the so-called early recovery plans usually is sort of 10-year, up to 10 years kind of plans. And I guess, in many ways, the development actors are probably led by UNDP, because worked for UNDP for 6 years, I didn't come across a land expert or a section at all, because some of these are really sort of governance issues, and they're related to conflict issues. If you work in conflict-affected settings, then I think, again, it has something to do probably with the funding, because the humanitarian cluster system usually get funding from some, you know, global appeals for specific disasters or conflicts. And I think that's where the sort of bureaucracy gets tangled up in these longer term from humanitarian emergencies to sort of medium to longer term governance issues just completely fall off the map.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think in the earlier funding, the appeal process, the early recovery cluster tends to miss out on it.
All right.
I was just wondering about another population group that you haven't mentioned, that I haven't seen a lot written about, that could also kind of comprise a cross-cutting issue around migrants or undocumented migrants living in settlements, not necessarily from the country that they're in, and how they, what their experience is of displacement, because they probably wouldn't have land tenure, but they also don't have citizenship or the right to reside or anything like that. Is there anything written on it?
I don't know, and I haven't had experience of that in any area case study I've looked at or worked in. The point I was going to say before is that the eligibility process is actually becomes incredibly abused and manipulated, and that's the other experience, is that you've got a window to identify people who are affected, and then to verify that. And then if you wait too long, then the really vulnerable groups actually get excluded and get populated by other groups. That's just the general.
I think it would be.
Was that an issue in Cambodia?
No, not in Cambodia. I think possibly in Thailand. It's an issue where you have a lot of migrants.
Right.
Undocumented migrants from other countries, and then they're exposed to a natural disaster or an environmental
process. But I've only seen very little in that. Make a good doctoral thesis.
Okay, thank you very much.